Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila.
And I'm Leo.
And tonight we have a good show for you. We have an interview with Larry Dorman that we'll be bringing you. He's talking about, let me explain who he is. He's the Public Affairs Coordinator for AFSCME Union Council 4 here in Connecticut. And he's going to help us to understand the healthcare coverage and bill that's coming up. It would be nice if it would be voted on before the summer recess, but I don't think it's going to be. He makes some comments about that. And he commented on other things here in the state of Connecticut. And so that'll be coming to you in about a half hour.
Yeah.
About a half hour. In the meantime, we're going to bring you some news, maybe some news that you won't hear on the mainstream media. And this particular article that I'm reading is from NewScientist.com. Microwave weapon will rain pain from the sky. I just have to give me a minute. I have to move a little bit closer to the light here. The Pentagon's enthusiasm for non-lethal crowd control weapons appears to have stepped up a gear with the decision to develop a microwave plane infliction system that can be fired from an aircraft. The device is an extension of the controversial active denial system, which uses microwaves to heat the surface of the skin, creating a painful sensation without burning that strongly motivates the target to flee. The ADS was unveiled in 2001, but it has not been deployed owing to legal issues and safety fears. Nevertheless, the Pentagon Joint Non-Lethal Weapons Directorate in Guantanamo, Virginia, has now called for it to be upgraded. The U.S. Air Force, whose radar technology the ADS is based on, is increasing its annual funding of the system from $2 million to $10 million. The transmitting antenna on the current system is 2 meters across, produces a single beam of similar width, and is steered mechanically, making it cumbersome. At the heart of the new weapon will be a compact airborne antenna, which will be steered electronically and be capable of generating multiple beams, each of which can be aimed while on the move. The ADS has been dogged by controversy. Jürgen Altman, a physicist at Dartmouth University in Germany, showed that the microwave beams can cause serious burns at levels not far above those required to repel people. This was verified when a U.S. airman was hospitalized with second-degree burns during testing in April of 2007. The airborne version will not make it any less contentious. Let me see. I'm having trouble reading this. I need the light. Independent of the mode of production, with the size of the antenna beam, will show variations of intensity with distance, not just a simple decrease up to about 500 meters, says Altman. Shooting it on the move with any accuracy will be difficult, he adds. Let's see. Dave Law, head of the technology division of JNLWO, says that the new antenna will operate at the lowest possible effective power level and will have a sophisticated automated target tracking system. Doesn't sound very nice. So, that's what's coming to the neighborhood near you folks. Sounds like it's going to be used on domestic people to crowd control, maybe. I don't know. A lot of things could be used.
Possible. Okay, I've got something here that I think we should read. It's by naturalnews.com, but 10 things you're not supposed to know about the swine flu vaccine. Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, National News Editor. She was deathly afraid of the flu, so she asked her doctor what she should do. He stabbed her unseen like a swine flu vac with a swine flu vaccine, blurting, "Darling, I haven't a clue." But let's not beat around the bush on this issue. The swine flu vaccine now is being prepared for mass injection into infants, children, teens, and adults. Have never been tested and won't be tested until the injections begin. In Europe, where flu vaccines are typically tested on hundreds of thousands of people before being unleashed on the masses, the European Medicine Agency is now is allowing companies to skip the testing process entirely. And yet, amazingly, people are lining up to take the vaccine absent any safety testing whatsoever. When the National Institute of Health in the U.S. announced the swine flu vaccine trial beginning in early August, it was inundated with phone calls and emails from people desperate to play the role of human guinea pigs. And the power of fear to herd sheeple into vaccine injections is simply amazing. And back in Europe, of course, everybody gets to be a guinea pig, since no testing will be done on the vaccine at all. Even worse, the European vaccines will be using adjuvants, chemicals used to multiply the potency of the active ingredients in vaccines. Notably, there is absolutely no safety data on the use of adjuvants in infants and unexpected mothers, the two groups being most aggressively targeted by the swine flu vaccine pushers. That leads us to the disturbing conclusion that the swine flu vaccine could be a modern medical disaster. It's untested, untried, its ingredients are potentially quite dangerous, and the adjuvants being used in the European vaccines are suspected of causing neurological disorders.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and paralyzed by vaccines. I probably don't need to remind you that in 1976, a failed swine flu vaccine caused irreparable damage to the nervous system of hundreds of people, paralyzing many. And medical doctors gave the problems a name, of course, to make it sound like they knew what they were talking about. Guillain-Barré syndrome. Notably, they never called it toxic vaccine syndrome because that would be too informative. But the fact remains that doctors never knew how the vaccines caused these severe problems. And if the same events played out today, all the doctors and vaccine pushers would undoubtedly deny any link between the vaccines and paralysis altogether. That's what's happening today in the debate over vaccines and autism, which is a complete denial. Mm-hmm. In fact, there are a whole lot of things you'll never be told by health authorities about the upcoming swine flu vaccine. In fact, there are a whole lot of things in health authorities about the coming for your amusement. I've written down the top 10 most down the 10 most obvious ones and published them below. So I'll let you go ahead.
Okay. 10 things you're not supposed to know about the swine vaccine. The production was rushed and the vaccine has never been tested on humans. Do you like to play guinea pig for the big pharma? If so, line up for your flu vaccine this fall. Swine vaccine contains dangerous adjuvants that cause inflammatory response in the body. That is why they are suspected of causing autism and other neurological disorders. The swine flu vaccine could actually increase your risk of death from swine flu by altering or suppressing your immune system response. There is zero evidence that even seasonal flu shots offer any meaningful protection for people who take the jabs. Vaccines are the snake oil of modern medicine. Let's see.
Doctors still don't know why the 1976 swine flu vaccines
paralyzed so many people. And that means they really have no clue whether the upcoming vaccine might cause the same devastating side effect. And they're not testing it either. Even if the swine flu kills you, the drug companies aren't responsible. The U.S. government has granted drug companies complete immunity against vaccine product liability. Thanks to the blanket immunity, drug companies have no incentive to make safe vaccines because they get paid based on quantity, not safety. No swine flu vaccine works as well as vitamin D to protect you from influenza. That's an inconvenient scientific fact that the U.S. government, the FDA, and Big Pharma hope the people never realize.
Even if the swine flu vaccine actually works, mathematically speaking, if everyone else around you gets the vaccine, you don't need one because it can't spread through the population you hang with. So even if you believe in the vaccine, all you need to do is encourage your friends to go get vaccinated.
Drug companies are making billions of dollars from the production of swine flu vaccine. That money comes out of your pocket, even if you don't get the jab, because it's all paid by the taxpayers. When people start dying in large numbers from the swine flu, rest assured many of them will be the very people who got the swine flu vaccine. Doctors will explain this away with their typical Big Pharma logic. The number saved is far greater than the number lost. Of course, the number saved is entirely fictional and imaginary and exists only in their warped heads. The swine flu vaccine centers that will crop up all over the world in the coming months aren't completely useless. They will provide an easy way to identify large groups of really stupid people. Too bad there isn't some sort of blue dye that we could tag them with for the future.
New reference. And the lottery, let's say... the lottery, they say, is a tax on people who can't do math. Especially flu vaccines are a tax on people who don't understand health.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to refer you to the April 20th show that we did with Dr. Cass Ingram. And that's featured on our show page as one of the shows featured there. Talks about swine flu and the problems with the vaccination that are actually causing the flu and causing other really serious complications. So let's go on. Let's see what else I got here for you. Do taser use on disabled man justify because he had an umbrella?
You don't carry an umbrella, folks.
You want me to check that one out? Or?
Nah, let's see what else there is.
Okay, $100 million bonus. Citicorp is considering paying $100 million bonus to one guy. This is the same Citicorp that received $45 billion in bailout money, the same Citicorp that will soon be 34% owned by the U.S. government, and the same Citicorp that has lost 95% of its share value since 2007. You want to read more? Or?
Let's find out who the guy is. Who's getting the money?
Okay. If we got it here. Citigroup is in no position to be awarding bonuses of $10 million, let alone adding another zero to that amount. So why is it mulling such a colossally dumb move? Because the guy demanding it is probably the bank's most valuable employee.
Enter Andrew Hall. He's a rock star, a legend among banking circles. He makes a boatload of money for Citigroup as head of Fibro, the bank's energy trading unit. The Wall Street Journal calls Fibro a secretive operation housed in a former Connecticut dairy farm that occasionally accounts for a disproportionate chunk of Citigroup income. Fibro made so much money for Citigroup last year that Hall got a $100 million bonus. His bonus is based on Fibro's profits. Fibro was the main source of the $667 million in pre-tax revenue Citigroup received in commodities trading, the Journal reported, and the unit is doing so well this year that Hall may be in line for a similar amount.
Even though it's only July, it sounds like Hall is pressing Citigroup for confirmation of the bonus. He's threatening to leave the company, reports say. So here's Citigroup's dilemma. Keeping Hall would likely help the company climb out of the hole it's in, but can it afford to spend $100 million? And will the U.S. government allow it? That will depend largely on the opinion of Kenneth Feinberg, the new pay czar appointed to oversee compensation of the bailout banks. Hal already has so much money that he owns a castle in Germany called Schloss Dürnberg. He's a huge art collector. And caused a bit of a ruckus in Southport, Connecticut, by commissioning a 6-ton, 80-foot-long sculpture of concrete and steel in his front lawn. It doesn't play well with the Southporters. And how will a $100 million bonus play with taxpayers? We'll see. So it's kind of, this guy kind of sounds like kind of a
piece of work.
Yeah.
How much is enough?
Yeah. Let's see. Is Israel preparing to attack Lebanon?
Here we go again. The warmongers. Israel is doing its best to go to war with Lebanon again in order to wipe the embarrassment they suffered in the last war with Hezbollah. Now these are doing their best to provoke the Lebanese and especially Hezbollah to fire the first shot so as to justify Israel's invasion. There are confirmed reports of advancing Israeli tanks in the Sheba Farms area. Six Israeli jets have entered Lebanese airspace and have circled the area. It seems that these Israeli Jews are never happy unless they have war in their blood, and they have the nerve to accuse average Arabs of trying to wipe Israel off the map.
Okay.
So that's the problem.
Yeah. Planning for a possible outbreak. Let's see if there's anything else.
Here's one. Family law. Men are kicked in the teeth. Brian's family was the last I expected to break up. Brian and Gail had been married 24 years. They had six children, ages 7 to 18, and were active in the pro-life movement. At elections, they were the only ones with the lawn sign for the Conservative Party. Brian, 46, ruggedly handsome and disheveled, was a carpenter and a bricklayer. He quit grad studies in city planning because he couldn't stand the politics. Brian is a very rare person. He is genuine. In April, he stopped a man from beating a woman on the downtown roadway. Hundreds of passerbys just stood and gawked. Ironic, he stood up for a woman and is now being crushed by feminist family law. Recently, I met Brian and learned why he and Gail had moved away.
It seemed Brian had a midlife crisis. He had fallen into deep depression and couldn't work. Perhaps the stress of operating a small business for 20 years had caught up to him. Many times it was, if you don't get the job, you don't eat, he said. But after 5 months of depression, Gail secretly got a restraining order, and a month later she ordered him out of the house. She told him she couldn't cope with his depression. She told the police she was afraid of his temper. While he waited in the bar, handcuffed like a common...
Waited in the police car.
Police car, right? Oh, I said that. A cop said he should be thankful. She could have falsely accused him of assault and put him in prison for weeks. In 24 years of marriage, Brian never hit Gail. And sure, he had a temper and occasionally raised his voice, so did she. It was a normal part of family life. Gail had been his best friend. Well, Brian forgives Gail and makes excuses for her. He champions causes that must have taken a toll on her. For example, he had received death threats for his defiance of a local biker gang. But the biggest factor was a neighbor who had just split up and filled Gail's head with feminist dogma. Gail told him, "I bet you never thought that sucky little Gail would become a strong, independent woman. This is how communist Satanist movements work, corrupting one mind at a time, whether it's destroying one family or so and so." I get a kick out of this guy. Once in a while, I read him from Henry MacHow.com. Kind of a conspiracy theorist, but more or less kind of a funny guy. But I'm going to go on from there.
Russian Navy UFO records say aliens love oceans. The Russian Navy has declassified its records of encounters with unidentified objects technologically surpassing anything humanity ever built, reports Svobodnaya Pressa news website. The records dating back to Soviet times were compiled by a special Navy group collecting reports of unexplained incidents delivered by submarines and military ships. The group was headed by Deputy Navy Commander Admiral Nikolai Smirnov, and the documents reveal numerous cases of possible UFO encounters. Vladimir Azhazha, former Navy officer and famous Russian UFO researcher, says the materials are of great value. 50% of the UFO encounters are connected with oceans, 15 more with lakes. So UFOs tend to stick to the water, he said.
Hang on one second. I'm just
finish the rest of that. Records dating back to Soviet times. Okay, well, we did that. On one occasion, a nuclear submarine, which was a combat mission in the Pacific Ocean, detected 6 unknown objects. After the crew failed to leave behind the pursuers by maneuvering, the captain ordered to surface. The objects followed suit, took to the air and flew away. Many mysterious events happened in the region of the Bermuda Triangle, recalls retired submarine commander Rear Admiral Yuri Beketov. Instruments malfunctioned with no apparent reason or detected strong interference. The former Navy officer said this could be deliberate disruption by UFOs. On several occasions, the instruments gave readings of material objects moving at incredible speed. Calculations showed speeds of 230 knots or 400 kph, speeding so fast is a challenge, even on the surface. But water resistance is much higher. It was like the objects defied the laws of physics. The only one explanation, the creatures who built them far surpassed us in development, said Beketov. Navy intelligence veteran Captain First Rank Igor Barkley comments, ocean UFOs often show up wherever our NATO fleets concentrate, near the Bahamas, Bermuda, or Puerto Rico. They are most often seen in the deepest part of the Atlantic Ocean and in the southern part of the Bermuda Triangle, also in the Caribbean Sea. Another place where people often report UFO encounters is the Russia's Lake Baikal, the deepest freshwater body in the world. Fishermen tell of powerful lights coming from the deep and objects flying up from the water. In one case in 1982, a group of military divers training at Baikal spotted a group of humanoid creatures dressed in silvery suits. The encounter happened at a depth of 50 meters, and the divers tried to catch the strangers. 3 of the 7 men died, while 4 others were severely injured. I think about underwater bases and say, why not? Nothing should be discarded, says Vladimir Eshaza. Skepticism is the easiest way. Believe nothing, do nothing. People really visit great depths, so it's very important to analyze what they encounter there. Meanwhile, Russian Navy officials have denied the collection of UFO-related encounters exists. A source in the Navy service staff said the story may have its roots in the reports of vessel commanders, which describe locating objects of unclear but earthly origin. Interesting.
Okay. And let's see what else we got here. That might be interesting for you. Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has failed to declare the presence of 30 ancient tombs on his land, according to a newly published record. A recording said to be of him. The recordings allege Mr. Berlusconi told escort Dedaro of 30 Phoenician tombs at his Sardinia villa, and his tombs date from 300 B.C., A man said to be Mr. Berlusconi was heard saying, but officials say there is no record of him reporting any fines, a legal requirement for all Italians, and opposition MPs have called for a probe.
He doesn't want to give up the artifact.
During
a discussion of the Obama birth certificate controversy, MSNBC host Chris Matthews and his guests implies that anyone who questions the official 9/11 story thinks that the Bilderberg Group are exercising power to create a world government. People who are worried about gun control and immigration or even people who are merely skeptical of government are psychologically insane.
Yeah.
You know, don't question anything, Mr. Matthews. See what else this does.
Yeah.
Responding to Matthew's implication that people who had questions about Obama's birthplace were full mooners and insane, NBC political analyst Howard Feynman included people who are worried about the government taking up guns, people who deny the federal government has the right to tax your income, people who are worried about being overrun at the borders in the same category, and they were merely looking for a reason to find a conspiracy behind Obama. So, pretty sick. Don't question anything, just, you know.
Well, no, I don't like Chris Matthews anyway, because he comes on so... He's such a cheerleader, you know? There's an Obama cheerleader.
Yeah, cheerleader for anything Democratic.
Yeah.
And this article is from PrisonPlanet.com. Okay, BBC may broadcast educational programs if the swine flu shuts schools. I guess they're planning that. Mandatory flu vaccines for all New York health workers proposed. Castle doctrine dies in Texas. Let's see. There's all kinds of things on here. Seattle, Vancouver, October 4th. David will be speaking all day at Mount Baker Theater in Bellingham, Washington State. Who is David?
Oh, it's David Icke.
Let's see.
Yeah, so.
See what that's.
No, he's just that's just about David Icke.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
We're just about ready for our interview anyway.
Yeah, I've almost got it up here. So if you can just bear with me a second, we will go with that. I want to make sure I can move on to that. There's one about the health workers.
Yeah, they're getting forced to get shots.
Yeah, and this one here, Incoherent Truth, you can read that one if you'd like. Actually, why don't you just, can you just read this one?
Yeah.
And, I should have it hooked up by then.
Okay, and from Cranes, NewYork.com. Flu shot on tap for health workers. State Department of Health is proposing mandatory flu vaccines for all health workers in the state. That's in New York. The new rule will apply not just to staff, but anyone who potentially comes into direct contact with patients. That includes contract workers, students, and volunteers. The proposal, which is still in draft form, would apply to everyone working in hospitals, diagnostic and treatment centers, certified home health agencies, long-term home health care programs, AIDS home care workers, licensed home care service agencies, and hospices. A separate rule is pending in the legislature that applies to nursing home workers. The state health department's move is an acknowledgement that voluntary flu vaccine efforts don't work. But it wasn't clear if the regulations would be implemented before any flu vaccinations for the H1N flu virus is manufactured. Although the CDC has recommended flu shots for health workers since 1981, voluntary participation is extremely low among New York health workers, a mere 40%. But at least one study showed that while 23% of healthcare personnel had serological evidence of flu infections, most of those, 59% in fact, could not ever recall having symptoms. Nonetheless, the potential for spreading infection among the elderly and weak patients is high. According to DOH data, 5,179 employees in hospitals and nursing homes were sickened either by suspected or confirmed flu infections between 2000 and 2007, while more than 19,000 hospital patients and nursing home residents fell into that category. Under the proposed regulations, the only people who would be exempt from getting flu vaccination by November 30th of each year would be those whose medical who had a medical reason for avoiding the shot. All health facilities would have to offer free shots, and the DOH didn't specify who would pay for them. Most likely, the facilities would. The facilities also would be responsible for documenting in personal files, in personnel files, all information relating to the vaccination, including the date, dose, and manufacturer, lot number, place of vaccination, and any reaction to the shot. By May 1st each year, the healthcare industry would report to DOH the number of people vaccinated by profession. You all set with that, Leo?
No, I had a problem here trying to rewind it so you can...
How far along are you?
We're almost there. Almost there. It's just a...
So we'll be ready in a minute to bring
I'm
you our...
So, yeah. I'm hoping so.
Our interview with Larry Dorman.
I hope so.
Larry Dorman is the Public Affairs Coordinator for the AFSCME Union. And we interviewed him about the health care bill and other issues that are important to all citizens. I think we have it now.
No. But that's okay. We're almost there. What I'm going to do is move along quickly here, and hopefully we'll be able to have that for you in just a second. Problem here that I had. Rewinding this thing.
So we should have at least maybe one more article to bring you before we bring you the interview.
I'm hoping that we can bring the interview now, but it's not working the way I want it to.
Should be on side one.
It is on side one, but it's not rewinding properly. I don't know why. Okay, give us a few more minutes here with this thing. I love this kind of technology. Anyway. Kind of interesting to note today. We're still waiting for this interview, and I'm sorry, folks, that it's been couldn't get it right here. But see, military poised to help FEMA battle swine flu breakout.
Huh.
Okay. U.S. Commander for Northern Command asked Defense Secretary to sign executive order for military to set up 5 regional teams to deal with their outbreak. Orders to deploy actual forces will be reviewed later. The Pentagon is preparing to help the Federal Emergency Management Agency tackle potential outbreak of H1N1 virus this fall. Fox News has confirmed. An advisory committee on immunization practices voted to set vaccination priorities for those groups Wednesday during a meeting in Atlanta. The vote came to on the same day that General Victor Renault, the U.S. commander for Northern Command, has asked Defense Secretary Robert Gates to sign an executive order for the military to set up 5 regional teams to deal with a potential outbreak of FEMA if FEMA requests help. And Gates is expected to sign the order soon. It is not known how many troops would be needed and whether they would come from the active duty or National Guard and Reserve forces. As a first step, Gates is being asked to sign a so-called execution order that would authorize the military to begin the conduct and to conduct the detailed planning.
I don't know what the military is going to do.
Well, they don't know. It doesn't seem like they know either here, but Barack is allowed.
Is that because they're forcing people to get vaccinations when they don't want them?
It's part of that. Might be part of that. Very well. Yeah. So... Anyway, and let's see, planning, got dog under there.
That's very strange, I think.
Yeah. Homeland Security unveils new anti-terror plans. I don't know if you want to read that. It's quick. Homeland Security Janet Napolitano outlined Wednesday the Obama administration's domestic approach to preventing terrorist attacks, a strategy that will rely in large measure on refining and expanding initiatives launched under President George W. Bush. In an interview this week, Napolitano signaled the Obama administration isn't contemplating a wholesale revision of the agencies or programs created under Mr. Bush to further anti-terrorism efforts. A great component of the integration efforts is a national network of roughly 70 so-called
intelligence fusion centers.
Yeah, and
they bring federal, state, and local officials under the same roof to fuse terrorism-related intelligence. Very strange.
Do you want to read more of that, or does it matter?
We could go to that. We'll keep going. These aren't that important. That's in one.
How about suspending constitutional rights?
Yeah, that's in jail, though. Central Men's Jail. Pandemic contingency planning. Government may invoke emergency clause to force BBC to air content. That's in England. They're going to have the BBC televise educational programs if there's a pandemic. Senate pages may have contracted swine flu, says top official. The H1N1 virus has arrived at Congress's doorstep. 5 Senate pages appear to have contracted the dreaded flu virus, which has been linked to more than 300 deaths, and they have been quarantined from their peers and lawmakers. Sergeant at Arms Terrence W. Gaynor announced Tuesday night in an internal memo to staff and senators. NHS cannot cope with the swine flu epidemic, report warns. Are you all set?
Yeah, we got it.
All right.
Okay.
We now have our interview with Larry Dorman.
The National Homeland Security, though, may not be able to cope with the swine flu epidemic this winter as intensive care beds will be overwhelmed. A Lord's report has warned. Well, preparation. I wonder if that's. Yeah.
That's England. England.
Yeah. So they got a problem there. We have problems everywhere. So, okay.
Let's have our interview. Yeah. I think we should move on to that.
Okay.
And this is an interview with Larry Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator from Ask the Union, talking to us about Obama's health bill, what's happening with it, and what the union hopes to do, and other thought-provoking subjects.
Yes.
So
here's Larry.
Here's Larry Dorman.
We'll be back right after this interview.
Hey, Larry. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing very well.
Good. We were hoping you could shed some light on the health care bill for us.
It gets more complicated every time we talk.
It is so complicated, and I was just Leo had pulled up an article called "Kill Grandma Bill" from Family Security Matters, and it talks a lot about reducing the money that's available for Medicare, and that's a real scare for seniors. And I don't really know how accurate that article is.
Nor do I. Do people stay on the Medicare bill, or I mean, will people be over 65 on Medicare, or will they wind up on the private?
Will
that just become one big private bill?
Who knows? Now that would, that's kind of the model of where we ought to actually head, having, Medicare for those under 65. Now, part of the Obama bill is to actually try to rein in some of the costs that are associated with Medicare. But again, when you talk about cost, it's not the fault or the responsibility or the creation of those who need treatment and care. You're talking about pharmaceutical companies, you're talking about insurance companies with tremendous profits, tremendous exorbitant executive pay, high administrative overhead. So I get very nervous when people talk about monitoring and reducing stuff is that they, you know, is often, you know, a reduction in benefits.
In service.
And a higher cost for consumers. But in many ways, the Medicare model ought to be a, you know, a national health care model.
Yeah, I thought it was a pretty good model. We've seen that in different articles that our Medicare system is pretty good compared to systems around the world.
And why? But and why wouldn't they just use that?
Why? I don't know why they don't
incorporate everybody into the Medicare program and
be done with it.
And be done with it. It'd be real simple.
That's my.
Really,
I don't understand this.
My belief, and I think it's you know, many in the labor movement would advocate that. I mean.
You know the silliest thing, though, and quite frankly, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but to me, paying extra taxes of some, I mean, I would sooner pay $1,000 a year more in personal taxes than I do right now, all right, knowing that I have full some kind of
medical coverage. Knowing everybody has health care.
You can't get, for $1,000, you can't get any kind of medical coverage, or, you know, you can barely see them visit a dental office, you know what I mean?
Well,
you know, today. So it's like for every person to pay $1,000 or $2,500 or $10, I don't know, whatever.
We would be a progressive.
Yeah, progressive.
Progressive tax.
Yeah.
Payroll tax. But look, here's what gets lost in the noisy chatter, you know, by the media and the ruling elites, which is that if you take health care, if you remove it, you know, the current system, it's an employer-based system.
Mm-hmm.
And as you all know and your listeners know, employers are increasingly retreating from providing decent health care if they provide it at all. So the burden, in many ways, has already been passed to working Americans. Yet, businesses complain about their ability to, you know, have a level playing field and about escalating costs of health care for those that do. And I feel for them, and I can appreciate.
But Darren, again, I have to. I can't understand.
We're removing. If you have some kind of universal health care system, ideally a single payer system, ultimately what you're doing is you're removing that as a competitive factor for businesses. So you're leveling the playing field. I can't think of a better and wiser thing to do in terms of the trade-off than to do it the way both of you are suggesting, because employers perhaps will begin hiring people. They'll stop laying off.
Here's an issue: is why are so many why are these small business lobbyists advocating against this bill, lobbying against this bill?
I think they're tragically misinformed.
I think you think they would be benefiting greatly by this.
No, I mean, what's interesting is that here in Connecticut, and you know, we just got through two battles for the Sustinet, legislation, which would provide a platform for making Connecticut a model provider of universal, accessible, affordable health care. And fortunately, the legislature, in its wisdom, overrode Governor Rell's veto, and that's great news. That happened since we last spoke. The other thing that happened, Governor Rell unfortunately vetoed the pooling, the health care pooling bill called the Connecticut Health Care Partnership, which would have allowed small businesses, nonprofit employers, and municipalities to participate in the state plan. And you know, what was heartening was to see the number of, there's a small business coalition that was that fought very aggressively and fiercely for pooling. Realtors, the Realtors Association, supported pooling. So I certainly hear what you're saying and agree with you broadly about the business community. But, you know, Connecticut, we saw some separation, fortunately. We saw many businesses and realtors willing to break away, you know, from the orthodox, narrow thinking of the business community, which is, you know, in many ways they're out there protecting the insurance industry. They're not protecting ordinary Americans. But, you know, I agree with you. You've removed this as a huge cost factor and a burden. Why wouldn't you support it?
Yeah,
right.
I don't understand it. It's like they're shooting themselves in the foot. You know, and a lot of this stuff. But again, the devil's in the details here, because it doesn't seem like anybody really knows what the details of this thing is.
Of the Obama?
The problem is that
you've gone from, you know, as is the process, and everything is about compromise and watering down. You know, the original bill, which is 3,200. H.R. 3200, if you read the mission statement, the title of the bill is, and I'm reading it from it right now, to provide affordable, quality health care for all Americans and reduce the growth in health care spending and for other purposes. So that certainly sounds wonderful. In writing. And what's happened is H.R. 3200 is now going through that a very torturous process of committee of adjustments by various committees of jurisdiction. And as we speak today, what's troubling is that Senate Democrats are trying to work out a kind of a backroom compromise with Republicans who are, you know, a vocal minority, but a minority nonetheless, and really don't purport to represent anybody, that they don't want to have a public option, that they want to exempt many employers from having to participate in a pay-or-play system. And so if that's where we end up, I think we end up with a very insufficient response. You know, what they're trying to do is reduce the cost of the Obama proposal. They want to actually expand Medicaid, provide federal subsidies for individuals and families, so on and so forth. So that part is good, but, you know, what's not so good is for them to be abandoning the idea of a public option. What's not so good is that, you know, let me stop there and just say that what we need to have as Americans, I think, is a choice of a private insurance plan. That would include keeping the insurance plan you have, like the one, for instance, you might be participating in, Lila, that
right.
was negotiated with your employer through your union,
mm-hmm.
or a public insurance plan without a private insurer, you know, playing the middleman. To, you know, that would guarantee affordable coverage. So right now, what's a little distressing is that there's a compromise effort afoot to move away from the public plan. And there's also a movement afoot to exempt many employers from the responsibility of paying into a system. So, you know, that's those are troubling developments, and that's what's going on. The grand principle of providing affordable, accessible health care is now in the hands of a lot of people who want to make deals and compromise. And it's really important that people, you know, get to their congresspeople. And at this point, if your listeners call Senators Dodd and Lieberman, that would be the most helpful thing they could do. Senator Dodd supports the public option, and of course, Senator Lieberman to date isn't committed and doesn't appear to support that.
Really?
Now that's what's going on.
People
need to make their voice heard.
Now, what about these Blue Dog Democrats? Are they going to be responsible for maybe destroying this health care bill? Do you think they have a lot of power?
I heard you say, do they have a responsibility to?
I said, do you think they're going to be responsible for really watering down and maybe destroying this health care bill?
That's, you know, as we speak tonight, that's certainly what's happening. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to be the final version, but this anxiety over really sticking to the principles, to the mm-hmm. broad principles of healthcare reform, could very well lead to, as I say, to a diluted plan that doesn't have a public option, that doesn't require employers to participate in the system. And by that I mean the pay or play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to.
Well, you know, the only thing actually that they've been talking about is the cost. You know, they're talking that the cost is they feel is prohibitive. But again, what are they, like six or seven or eight people there? Six or seven guys. That's about it.
They're worried about the cost of the subsidies is what they're worried about.
Yeah, the cost of everything in it, but they don't see it being brought in.
And here's one of the ironies from what I've been reading about it. And again, I'll focus in
sure,
on the fact that I think to the president's credit, to the credit of a lot of Democrats, including Congressman Murphy, who represents my district and yours,
mm-hmm.
my town and yours.
He voted for cap and trade, though.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But you know, getting back to the H.R. 3200, I want to just focus for a second, just talk about the employer responsibility, because we started the show with that. This bill would provide, you know, would require employers to provide health care coverage for their workers. Otherwise, they would pay into a fund that, according to economic and government studies, would save small businesses as much as $855 billion
wow.
in the next few years. And that's from a lobbying group called the Small Business Majority. So, you know, that's kind of what we're talking about, that the Blue Dogs and everybody else, and those who oppose comprehensive reform are willing to throw out the window. You know, there's, you know, you're talking about a 36% reduction in costs. And, you know, that's money that could be reinvested mm-hmm. to grow the economy again. I mean, healthcare costs are soaring, and they're soaring for employers. So, you know, the risks are really great if this effort is diluted, and you know, it really brings us back to that fundamental question that you both have been asking on your show, which is why not have a single payer universal system? Because maybe all of this complicated wrangling is what's leading to the problems we have.
Yeah, and I'm really disappointed that something isn't going to be passed before they all go on vacation. I'm worried about that,
but for some reason I'm not, and the reason I'm not is because, I mean, when the last time they rushed through something, they rushed through the bailout, which was an absolute debacle. It was absolutely.
Well, I don't think they have any trouble rushing through something that pays bankers and the elite.
And but the minute it comes to
something that helps Americans in general, all of a sudden you can't rush through anything.
Yeah, right.
I agree with
that. I think the problem is that the
very people who helped legislate us into the crisis, driven in large part by all those toxic mortgage loans, their apologists in Congress wrote the bailout legislation to benefit executives.
That's right.
Nothing in there for refinance loans.
Yeah, well, you saw with the Citicorp consultant.
Yes.
Is going to get paid $100 million for his.
Exactly.
But
point is one that I have to agree with. They couldn't trip over themselves fast enough in the Bush Congress to provide a bailout package that ignored ordinary working Americans
and
benefited the corporations. Now we have something that actually will benefit ordinary working families again.
Right.
And
all of a sudden it has to be parsed over and examined thoroughly.
Being, parsed almost into, hopefully not into a, non-existence, but it's being put over the coals. And that's why, again, I would urge people to make calls, write letters, and focus on your senators, Dodd and Lieberman, and make your voice heard that you want accessible, affordable coverage for every American, and that there has to be a public option. It can't be something that's dictated by the private insurance industry. And then it just has to be a core part of the plan. Otherwise, I don't think we're going to get what we want, more importantly, what working Americans deserve. And that's where we stand.
I also think it would be a much better plan if the Senate and the House of Representatives took part in it, and they didn't have their own exclusive plan.
Yeah, another interesting point, because they're
opting out. They're opting out of the public plan themselves, all right, and for their own private plans that they have with the government.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders, the wonderful senator from Vermont, socialist as well, and, he said...
Rhode Island, right?
He always said, why can't we just simply provide Americans with the same health and pension coverage that Congress gets?
Yeah.
And if you say that to a conservative Republican congressman, they look at you in horror. But you know what? That ought to be the standard if it's good enough for them.
That's right.
Why isn't it good enough for hundreds of millions of...
Or if it's too good for us, then it should be... I mean, we're the ones that put them in office. They should take the same plan we do. All right, if it's a reduction...
I think it would be a much better plan if they had a vested interest.
I do, too.
And I think that should be part of it as well.
I agree, and maybe that's, the problem is some of the disconnect between having their own Cadillac coverage that we pay for and...
They vote that in every year.
And heavily influenced by insurance and pharmaceutical lobbyists. Now, again, I want to say that the Connecticut delegation... Particularly, R. Chris Murphy, John Larson, Rosa DeLauro, they've been great. Joe Courtney has been wonderful. And Joe Courtney down in southeastern Connecticut is getting, he could have a tough race on his hands, and he's getting a lot of heat for standing up for the principles that we've embraced for universal care. So we do have good people doing, fighting for us in Washington on this issue.
Well, you think,
again,
you think,
emphasize,
you think Dodd may be on his last legs here?
Well, sticking to the issue of health care, who knows? Obviously, you're talking about the countrywide mess that
yeah.
getting bigger than
well, not just that. I mean, he was the chairman of the finance committee, the Senate Finance Committee, that allowed all these mortgages to go through, and then he doctored these things up, and he did all kinds of horrible things.
Now he is a sitting U.S. senator who is for this fight. You know, that doesn't need to be said, and by contrast,
but the only reason he's fighting is
I'm not trying to gloss over the issue you're raising. I'm simply saying that right now, if we're going to put pressure on our senators, the pressure really needs to, we need Joe Lieberman to hear us, that the public option has to be.
He's not going to listen to anybody unless they're Republicans. Those are the ones that put him in office to begin with.
You know what, that would probably be, that might be the best thing, would be for conservatives and Republicans to,
probably listen to them.
We are going to be trying to make our voice heard. AFSCME, we're going to be doing a nationwide tour of 20 cities, spotlighting problems in health care. We're going to be putting our members forward. And look, many of our members actually have decent and better than decent health care because they have a union fighting for them at the table.
Mm-hmm.
But we've always embraced this fight because the more Americans who are without insurance, the worse it is for us as a nation, and the worse it is for our sense of community and our broader health and well-being. So we all need to have health care, and we all need to pitch in and do our part. And that's the bottom line. So we'll be trying to raise the volume on the debate. Labor Day, Congress is pretty much going into recess in the month of August through Labor Day. So
do you have some ads going on TV and radio and that kind of thing?
Well, yeah, Connecticut may not necessarily be one of those battleground states, but we, Council 4, will be out there in communities like yours with members like you, and I'll probably ask you to communicating in your area, Lila, about the importance of supporting the principles.
And glad to do it. We want to find out about how the Red Cross.
Lila's right on me. Yeah,
good timing, or maybe not good timing, but appropriate timing.
Yeah, we wanted to ask you about this because it's you're in some heated debate negotiations.
Yeah, we have. We're having a terrible time with the supposedly beneficent American Red Cross Blood Services region. We represent over 200 blood collection workers, and if you've participated or your listeners have participated in a blood drive, the people who take your blood, process you, ensure the safety of the blood, transport it to hospitals and medical centers safely. They've been working without a contract since the end of April. The company wants to really destroy their wage standard, take away their ability or their right to bargain over health care. They want to take registered nurses off of blood drives. They want to compress the hours of rest between blood drives, and our people can be out there 12 to 16 hours a day, including driving, because they go all over the state from Farmington. We feel the Red Cross, and this is happening, unfortunately, in several states, the Red Cross is really trying to hammer their employees, and that ultimately endangers donors. Obviously, it endangers the workers. I think the Red Cross is trying to create a disposable workforce, a throwaway workforce, and meanwhile, they're making exorbitant executive salaries both in Washington and Connecticut. They offer, I don't know if your listeners know this, they have a blood incentive program for their management team, so the more blood they get a cut of it when they sell it to hospitals.
I just wanted to mention before I continue this, we have about 46 seconds for any of those who are listening. You can call 646-915-9505 and listen to the remainder. There's probably about 10 minutes left to the interview. If not, you can pick it up on our archives immediately after the show. So, again, you can call 646-915-9505 and listen to the remainder of the program. Otherwise, go right into the archives. And I thank you for listening tonight, and we'll continue. Join us tomorrow, please, at the same time.
Now, I remember back in the 70s when they struck, when the workers struck. Back then, they were selling blood to pharmaceutical companies and hospitals for $100 a pint. All right. Now, I'm sure, and that depended on, that was like type O or something.
Yep.
And, you know, the rarer the blood, the more they got for it. I haven't priced a pint of blood recently, but I'll guarantee you it's probably topping 200 or more, all right, since 1970. It's got to be at least double, right?
You know, they,
They're getting it for nothing.
Yes.
All right.
Yep.
And you know they're paying nothing for the supply other than to.
What do they sell it for?
What they do? They sell it to the hospitals for? I don't know that.
Pharmaceutical companies are the biggest buyers of blood, actually.
But it's overall a multi-million-dollar enterprise.
Really?
In Connecticut, I think the.
Probably a multi-billion-dollar.
Almost 4% increase in what they charge hospitals. So,
well,
you know, this is.
But they're trying to hammer the workers and make them give up everything that they have,
right.
Despite the fact that they're making enormous profits.
Yep.
And jeopardize the safety of the operation because they're taking nurses off the blood drives. Okay, leaving technicians there and then working these guys 16 hours a day. That's just wrong. I mean, this is the American Red Cross here, right?
And practically wrong. And that's what we're fighting against. So we are having a big rally on Wednesday, August 5th. It's Wednesday at 4 o'clock in front of the Red Cross headquarters in Farmington, Connecticut. The information is on our website at council4.org.
Mm-hmm.
We also have a Red Cross Action Center. And I think you're going to be seeing more activity. And we'd like people, if they click onto the Action Center, they can find out how to contact the company CEO in Connecticut, send him a message. But we need people to really think twice about how the Red Cross behaves, and if any of your listeners are planning on participating in a blood drive, I certainly encourage that. I would simply ask them to let the Red Cross management know that they are offended and concerned about the Red Cross's treatment of its workforce, and that you know, down the line, giving blood won't be such an automatic action.
Now, how many workers are we talking about?
There are also alternative places people can go.
I don't know that there are not many alternatives. One of them is Bay State Medical out of Springfield, which I believe travels into Connecticut. There are some medical centers that do it, so, you know, there are alternatives. But, you know, ultimately this is about holding the Red Cross accountable. And,
yeah,
but
I mean, if people, you know.
How many workers are we talking about?
Connecticut, 225 unionized workers, and they have at least a quarter of that in management people. So many of them are, you know, making quite a lot of money and don't seem to bring a whole lot to the table. So, but we represent 225 frontline workers and laboratory workers back in Farmington who are really the ones, they're the ones responsible for protecting the safety and the integrity of the blood supply. So I think that if Red Cross's goal is to force a strike, then that clearly is going to endanger the blood supply. That's the bottom line. Obviously, our workers don't want to, would prefer not to strike. That could be a very difficult thing to do in this economy, albeit I think a courageous one, but the goal is to get a fair settlement. But, you know, people have to let the Red Cross know that they don't appreciate the company, a very profitable company.
Well, you know, I was just
seeming to go out of its way to endanger donors and to endanger workers.
I was just watching C-SPAN, a couple of nights ago, and they had this the director of, not director, the president and CEO of the Red Cross. She was like a young woman, probably in her late 30s, early 40s.
Stubborn, yep.
All right. And she was up there saying, and she was in front of the National Press Corps or something, and she was saying,
oh, we're so happy. We just got, we're doing so well. You know, we just got a tremendous donation from such and such corporation, and we're so pleased with it. This, you know, $5 million we received from here, $10 million from there, $3 million from here. She was naming all of the millions of dollars and the donors that they've received money from just in the last beginning, since the beginning of the year.
They're doing very, very well.
Yeah, right. So it's like, you know, they can't say, well, let's crush the union so we can, you know. Right? I mean,
it's about using the economy, too. That's always, even if that company is doing very well, they talk, most employers talk about the economy now, whether it really is affecting them negatively or not, and use that as a lever to not compensate their workers fairly.
Right, exactly, and too many, and they're just, you know, one more giant corporation or medium-sized corporation.
And it's supposed to be a non-profit.
Watching their workers.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable.
And thank God we have unions that watch out for the workers.
Right,
because
you
have no voice at all when you're dealing with a large corporation like that. It's very, very important that you have representation and solidarity among union members so that they stand up for their brothers and sister union members who are being exploited and not treated well.
I appreciate you saying that, and that really is the nature of our fight. And, you know, again, I think people, you can learn more about this on council4.org. If you want to come to the rally, please do. Or if you want to make a phone call or send an email to the company CEO telling them you don't appreciate their treatment of the workers, that would be very, very helpful and very powerful.
We can do that. Okay. So everybody, you don't have the phone number there, right?
Do people just go on to Council 4?
Yeah, you know, I should have it memorized by now, but I don't. But there's a... when you go to the Council 4 website, council4.org, and click on the, in the middle of the page, there's a Red Cross Action Center, and the company, Paul Sullivan is the CEO, and his email address and phone number are there.
Okay.
Right.
Now, again, if people can try to come to the rally next Wednesday, very, very much appreciated.
All right. That's great. And thank you, Larry, very much.
Thanks for having me. And Leo, give me a call tomorrow.
I sure will.
Okay.
Good night, Larry.
Bye.
That was Larry Dorman, Public Affairs Coordinator for the AFSCME Union, helping us to understand this health care bill. It's a little bit confusing. And also to remind folks, please go to council4.org and go to the Action Center, and you can find the telephone number for Paul Sullivan and either call him or write to him and let him know that you're upset about the treatment of the frontline workers who collect blood for the Red Cross. And they're on.
Also, don't forget.
Having a rough time.
They're having that rally there.
August 5th, outside of the headquarters, which are right there in Farmington.
What you're supporting, folks, is not. You're not supporting this.
This is a company that makes huge amount of money.
Billions.
And they're unwilling to treat their frontline workers.
Well over $1.5 million a year, and it's like shitting my gut. You know, come on. Just know that these are the people that are taking your blood. These are the people that are out there
ensuring your health and the health of the and the safety of the blood that's collected.
Yeah.
And we're here for station ID.
Yes. This is WQQQ 103.3.
Okay. I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. I hope that you got something out of that and learned a little bit about the Obama health care plan. Hope you join us tomorrow night when we discuss going to the spiritual realm and discuss. We'll be discussing some esoteric knowledge and readings from great masters. And then Friday night with George Dixon as we continue our discussion on the Mayan calendar and on ascension consciousness and possibly enter into the. Human origins and alien extraterrestrial interventions. So that's our topics on Friday. So hopefully you can join us tomorrow night or Friday night or both. And we thank you very much for joining us tonight. And have a pleasant evening. Okay.